Point of view, since my life's work is family studies and counseling and marriage and the family and those kinds of things, and I get to preach a lot about all of God's Word, but I love this area of study. But let me encourage you, if you have questions, talk to me about things that you want to talk to me about. I am really excited always about discussing. I do not know all the answers. I am so thankful that Bart is here to take care of that for me. Those questions I don't know the answer to, he's here. And so we're going to look into several things. But let me tell you this, there is no great marriage without a great relationship. And relationships are hard. Gary Chapman says in his book on Languages of Love that the world's greatest accomplishments are not found in the achievements that we make. We got some very great people here. You've done some fantastic things in your life. But no thing that you have done is as important as the relationships in your life. Relationships are the most important things in the world. It begins with a relationship with God, and then that next relationship, husband and wife, and that next relationship are those children and your family. So relationships are the most important thing in the world. Now, I want to share a thing or two with you. Let's look at the next slide. I can see you're upset with me. Maybe you should post more about it on Facebook. That should help eliminate any drama. That's a postmodern idea, isn't it? But Facebook is killing a lot of relationships. Internet is killing a lot of relationships. I can tell you, I could name you five preachers just like that who have lost their jobs. Some of them lost their spouse because they got on the internet and started looking and found somebody to communicate with on the internet. They wound up meeting at a motel and an affair starts because of the internet. The internet is a relationship killer in a lot of marriages. In the marriage counseling that I do, I can tell you, every one of them in some way or another, texting, sexting, Facebook, Instagram, all of those kinds of things that are so neat that your kids know a whole lot more about than you do, are really dangerous things in relationships. Next slide, please. Whew, we already saw that slide. We're not supposed to see it again. Could you get the next one up there? I'm just kidding. I put that up there just to remind us. How about the next slide, please? Marriage is a relationship, which is one is always right and the other is the husband. You all will have to think about that a little bit. If you're thinking about your relationship, you might want to think about that just a little bit. Next slide, please. Don't ever, ever upset a guy that owns a backhoe. Those relationships are pretty important, and sometimes it might not be a backhoe that your spouse owns, but wow, sometimes it winds up just about like that. We don't have much room for movement when those kinds of things occur. Next slide, please. Whew, I'm a little stressed right now. Just turn around and leave quietly and no one gets hurt. Okay, now, are y'all in a real honest mood? I mean, you ready to tell me the absolute truth? How many of you tonight are at least a little stressed out about something? You see, most of us are, and probably some that wouldn't raise their hand if you said, do you want to go to heaven now? There'd be one at least in here probably that wouldn't raise their hand. We just are born that way. But most of us are stressed out about something. Stress is a relationship killer. It really does create many, many problems. Next slide, please. Now, if you look at this, relationships are what connect us to each other, sons, daughters, mothers, fathers, siblings, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, caregivers, colleagues, mates, lovers, partners, coaches, mentors, and buddies. And here's one thing that research shows us about relationships, that not only do healthy relationships protect us from ill health, but that improving our relationships can improve our health. Have you ever been so frustrated with your spouse that your back hurts? You know, you're so your stomach is churning and you've got an upset stomach. Oh, my head aches. I'm so tired of thinking about that and fussing about that. You see, at the very lowest level, problems in marriage create health problems. Now, I don't know how you all are. I know that this group is a ton more mature than I am. But have y'all noticed I'm an old guy? And if I get up in the morning and something happens negatively between Jan and me, and I go to work without straightening that out, guess how my whole day is? It is not good. I don't want to talk to the students. I don't want to deal with people. I don't want to do my work. I don't want to do anything. You see, I'm emotionally crunched, and I don't like that. In fact, I don't like life when I'm that way. So what we have is a very clear indication, personally, or at least I do. You have to decide if you do. But personally, I can tell you my health emotionally, mentally, psychologically, physically is all much better when Jan and I have that feeling and she gives me the look. I like that. And I feel better in every way. Next slide, please. Now, this is something I use in my personal counseling class for Bible majors. Excuse me. There's probably at least one person in this room that thinks that psychology and counseling are just a lot of baloney, as we say in Tennessee. Does that communicate with y'all here in Kentucky? They don't think much of it. But let me tell you what. If you take a look at this, everything, it doesn't matter what it is, everything starts with God. And then revelation follows. What God is willing to reveal to us. If you look over here on the left, we're real familiar with that. We're real familiar with the Bible, the special revelation of God. And when you study to preach and you study to teach, you study to know what God says, you're going to exegete Scripture. You're going to break it down. You're going to understand what words mean. You're going to see how those things are put together. And you are going to be able to correctly interpret using those exegetical principles and hermeneutical principles, which just means how to interpret what is being said. You're going to use those and you're going to come up with some theological conclusions. What is God saying to us? And so we have those. You hear them in sermons. You read them in the Bible. You hear them in Bible class. You think through them. But over on the other side, we sometimes think this side over here is all about God and this side over here is all about man. Ain't so. It just is not so. God is the one who created all of nature. He created you and me to think. He created us to reason. He created us to use the world, to use animals for our good, for example. He created us to use our thinking processes to help us with disease. We look at somebody that grew mold on bread and developed penicillin out of it. You see, those are God-given abilities. And those circumstances in that mold that would help create an antibiotic that's been so helpful to us, that's from God. That's not from man. Man didn't create an antibiotic. Man discovered an antibiotic. God created it. So God gives us these ways of thinking and learning. And the very same thing's true with the mind. We have the ability to reason. There is no chapter in the Bible that discusses how to treat a person with cancer. I'm just guaranteeing you there's somebody in this room that has had cancer and has had treatment. The physician that treated you did not read Jude chapter 2 and find out how to treat people for cancer. Someone used their mind and they discovered. God created, they discovered how to go about treating some forms of cancer. We haven't discovered how to treat them all yet, but we're working on it. And I'm confident more will be learned. But God creates the cure. We simply discover it. The same thing is true with no Bible passage could teach us how to deal with obsessive compulsive disorder. Now, my buddy Mike Cravens, I tease him about being obsessive compulsive. If he were working with me, I would say, Mike, where do you want the stand? And he'll say, just put it wherever you want it. I'll say, well, listen, let's just move it one time and let's put it where you want it because it doesn't matter to me and I know it does to you. He won't tell me. So I put it here. He gets up to teach and he picks it up and he's going to put it here. He's going to put it exactly where he wants to. He's going to have everything laying in straight order. My stuff up here, I've got one thing laying this way, one thing laying this way, and we're a little bit different. We don't have a way of dealing with a clinically obsessive compulsive person that you can find in the Bible. I don't know if you've ever been around anybody that's clinical in obsessive compulsive, but it destroys their life. They, for example, will straighten their socks up before they go to work, and they'll go to the door and they'll take every sock out, they'll put their socks back in, they'll start to go out the door, and they're going to go back, and they take them out again, and they will do that over and over and over and over. And those of us that are normal say, well, listen, stupid, just stop it. Well, they would if they could, because they're destroying their lives. They're miserable. They're hurting. But we have learned how to intervene. Using our thought processes and our reasoning, we can intervene in the lives of people who have disorders of different kinds that are very debilitating, that they will not fix on their own and sometimes cannot fix on their own. So my point is, God creates the cure. We discover it. And psychology is not any different from medicine or any other thing in that regard. So we use scientific research and we learn how to intervene. I have books in my office that just give you possibility after possibility for intervention on about any kind of disorder that you want to talk about. So we study and we draw psychological conclusions. Now let me tell you the truth in my study. I've never seen one sound psychological principle that is not in harmony with God's will. Every single principle that sound in psychology fits the Word of God. Now, I've read some counselor that said, let me tell you how to fix your marriage. If you're having trouble getting along in marriage, I recommend that you each develop an affair. That will solve your problems. It would solve every problem I have. My wife would beat me to death. Having an affair is not a way to fix a marriage. I don't know how a guy who is thinking in his right mind psychologically could think that interjecting that kind of a relationship into a marriage would be of benefit. But if you take sound psychological principles, sound biblical theological principles, and you synthesize them, you put them together, you can have a really good Christian counseling theory, where you can be helped both spiritually and psychologically. And that makes a big, big difference. And I just wanted to share that with you because sometimes people get the impression that that side over there with that psychology junk, that's just all about man. It's not. God created us to be able to think and reason and intervene in our own lives. And so it helps. Next slide, please. I want to give you real quickly, and I'm going to try to run through these real quickly, but they're really good. 10 tips for healthy relationships. How do you make relationships healthy? And I'm telling you, some of you probably ought to think about some of these. Next slide, please. Here are 10 tips for healthy relationships. Number one, keep expectations realistic. You know, if my wife's dad had been a fantastic mechanic, and he was, he could fix about anything. Jan married a dunce. Mechanical dunce. I don't know how to fix anything. If Jan, every time she was home and a fan broke, dad take that thing in a few minutes, he'd hand it back to her and it's working. She hands it to me, I throw it in the trash and go buy another one. I don't know how to fix anything. If her expectation of me was to be a mechanic like her dad, he made a living fixing cars sometimes, repairing automobiles. I don't know how to do anything. I can fix a flat. That's about it. But be realistic. Don't demand something of people in relationships with you, and especially your spouse, especially your children, that they can't do. I've seen dads try to make a baseball player out of a kid that had zero coordination. And the dad would just hit a ball and it'd smash the kid, and the dad's telling the kid, get up from there, get tough, quit crying, get up there, you can do this. And the kid has no interest, he has no ability to do what his dad's trying to make him do. And we do that with our spouses, we do that with our children. Be realistic. Talk with each other about anything. Now, again, I want to tell you, I understand y'all are more mature than Jan and I are, as me. I don't leave Jan out of this. Because the other day, I got my feelings hurt about almost nothing. I went for a whole day miserable. I came in. Jan had already gone to bed. I'd been out doing counseling. I came in probably 9 o'clock at night. She's sitting, lay in bed reading, and I sit down on the bed, and I said, listen, I'm going to tell you something you already know. I said, I am so stupid. She smiled and said, yeah. And I said, you know, I have had my feelings hurt over whatever it was, and I don't remember what it was now, but it was nothing. It was absolutely nothing. You would roll your eyes like your kids do if I could think what it was, and I wouldn't be embarrassed to tell you. But it was just over nothing. And I spent a whole day in misery. And I sat down and I said, I'm not going any farther with this. We got to talk about this and forget it. And she said, that's a good idea. Where'd you come up with that, Mr. Obvious? And so we sat down and talked about it a little bit, and it was nothing. It was nothing to her. It was nothing to me. But it was something really big because we did not talk about it in the right way. Communication has to be there about anything and everything. The embarrassing stuff, those anger things, those frustrating things, it has to be there. Be flexible. Life is not going to work the way you want it to. We have a 16-year-old granddaughter that we're raising. We've had her since her birth, just about. And she's got a life. Believe me, 16-year-olds have a life. She's going in every direction. My wife has a life. She has plans that she wants to do and things she wants to do. And I am crazy at times. My schedule gets a little out of round and a little out of whack. And I want to go. Well, Jan will say, listen, you know what we need to do? We need to do this. And I look and I say, well, I can't. I've got to go to Glasgow, Kentucky. Cora says, well, I can't do that anyway. She starts telling us what she's got. So Jan's frustrated. And then I say, okay, she's wanting to do something. And so we have a little rinky-dink cabin up at Kentucky Lake. And I'll say, Jan, let's go to the cabin this weekend. We'll do stuff at the cabin this weekend. She'll say, well, I can't do it. I got to do this. I don't think y'all are probably that way, are you? Have trouble scheduling things in your life. You see, it's frustrating. And if you aren't flexible, if you think, oh, I've got to do this now and we're going to be this way or do this thing, you're going to really be hurt. We try to keep people in situations exactly like we like them. Next slide, please. Take care of you. You know, we get told, you know, don't be selfish. But sometimes we need a self-focus. We need to learn to say no. We need to take care of our life's problems. If my children need something and my neighbor needs something, I need to take care of my children unless this is some kind of emergency that just can't wait. Sometimes things have to be done. But I need to take first things first, and I need to take care of me and my relationships and my health, and I need to work hard at that, because if I am in the best frame of mind I can be in, boy, my wife's going to be a lot happier. My kids are going to be a lot happier. My grandkids are going to be a lot happier. And then be dependable. I don't know about Glasgow, Kentucky, but Henderson, Tennessee has a lot of people that if you say, we need some help, who will be there? There will be people, I'll be there, because that looks good in a group. I'll be there. And when it comes time to get, they don't show up. They didn't call you. They don't show up. They are not dependable. And it kills relationships. If you tell somebody you will do something, do it. Or if you cannot do it, everybody understands the problem, let them know. So be dependable. Next slide. Fight fair. Woo! I was doing one of these one time, and I said fight fair. And there was a sweet little lady who came up to me. She said, I can't believe you're telling couples to go home and fight. I said, I'm not thinking of punching each other. What I'm talking about is there's not a person in this room in any relationship but that you will eventually have differences. You won't like some things. You want to do something they don't want to do. You want to go somewhere they don't want to go. You're going to have differences. How do you deal with that in the family? How do you deal with those kinds of things where conflict arises? Fight fair. Give them a chance to say what they like. You say what you like, and then work out something mutually acceptable. If you're not flexible, you demand your way, the conflict is going to grow. So you need to really work hard at fighting fair. Show your warmth. I am from a very loving family. My brothers and sisters, we hug each other, we tell each other, we love each other. You know, if I call one of them, that's what we do. Some of you probably get lockjaw if you ever start thinking about telling anybody, including your spouse, you love them. But that just flows with our family pretty well. And it's meaningful because it's backed up by the behavior that we share among ourselves. So we need that. Now, I am a hugger. I've already hugged one or two people here that I don't know, and you didn't know me. And sometimes that really works. People like that. But boy, sometimes they don't. You know, when if I have a student in class, and they go, they ask me something, and I will come to them, and I almost always will put my hand, can I touch your shoulder here? I will always say, how can I help you? And I will lean down like this, and I'll touch them there. Boy, sometimes you get that, and I'm saying, okay, I'm thinking they don't want me touching them. And so I don't do that. But people like warmth, whatever kind of warmth they like. If you want great relationships, you be warm toward other people. Express yourself with warmth, and that is appropriate physical touch is so important. Appropriate communication is so very important. Healthy relationships show emotional warmth. Next slide, please. Keep life balanced. Boy, can you put a zero right up there on my forehead? Because sometimes my life gets so out of round with me having things to do. My daughter was in a play Monday night, and I couldn't go. Just made me sick. I had some counseling appointments lined up that were so very important to those people. This play was only one night, and I didn't know which night it was, or I would have not scheduled appointments for that time. But I could not undo what I did with the people that were there. So I missed a play. My life is out of balance sometimes with doing too much, and I need to do that. But if you are a parent or a grandparent and your kids are in sports, boy, you get life gets out of round in a hurry, doesn't it? And they're in school things and you're doing all kinds of things. We need to be balanced. And then we need to realize that relationships are a process. Sometimes it looks like everyone else is confident and everything's going their way. And when we get down, we've got a faculty member or two that if I were to share with Bart, for example, some of our Bible faculty members, some of the conversations I've had, and whose self-concept is about that high, it would blow you away. We just think they've got the world by the tail, man. They are so knowledgeable. They speak it to everybody and they do everything, but they cannot learn to feel good about themselves, and that makes their relationships a little bit harder. And it's a process of learning. It's just a step at a time in developing and keeping and maintaining not just a relationship with other people, but with yourself as well. Next slide, please. And then, boy, if I could help people with something, it would be this. Be yourself. I constantly run into people when they hear the term doctor. Boy, that means you got to be something special. Oh, it doesn't. Here's what that means. It means I went to school one more day, did one more assignment, I finished that class, I signed up for another class, and I went to school another day, and I did another assignment, and they give me a grade for that class, and I sign up for another one. You just keep going to school, and you keep doing your work day by day. It is nothing big time about it in many ways. It is nothing to be arrogant about. It is nothing for anyone who doesn't have it to feel sad about. There are people in this room, I've got brothers that did not finish high school. They dropped out of school to go to work when my dad died. They have a lot more on the ball than I do. When they're in certain areas, they just look at me and smile, and they're thinking, educated dummy. Because I don't know anything about what they know. And you see, I have to respect what they know. I mean, I do respect what they know. But they respect what I know. But it's not a big deal to them. And it should not be to us. Be yourself, no matter who you're around. You are significant enough to fit in anywhere you choose to fit in that's good. You're good enough. You're smart enough. You're whatever enough that it takes to fit in. Every one of us. It's not about being so skinny, nobody cares, or so heavy, nobody cares, or so tall, nobody cares, or so short that nobody cares. It's just about being you, and you're okay. We can get better, but it's okay. So we need to be people who are real. What you see is what you get. That makes the best lawyers, the best doctors, the best teachers, the best preachers, the best friends. Just be yourself, and that would help. Okay, next slide. Now, I want to share with you a much better list. It's shorter, but boy, I really could stay till midnight talking about these things. This is the greatest sermon on relationships, in my opinion. That's all it is. The greatest sermon on relationships that I have ever read, Matthew chapter 18. When you take a look at Matthew chapter 18, you'll see the record that is shown again in Luke chapter 9, where Jesus is with his closest friends. They're with the Son of God, and they're arguing over who's the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Boy, that would be embarrassing. To know that Jesus was listening to that kind of conversation. Couldn't you hear John say, well, you know, I'm the one that Jesus loved. And Peter would say, well, listen, that's no big deal. I'm the one that opened the keys to the kingdom. Andrew might look at Peter and say, listen, you wouldn't have been anything if I hadn't brought you to Jesus. You know, they have their own thing. And here's this old guy. My favorite Bible character is John. And the reason he is because I see myself having been a little bit like John. Did you know that Jesus called him and his brother a son of thunder? Pretty aggressive nature. Well, let's just call that people reject you. Let's just call fire down from heaven and just destroy that village. Man, if you ever saw me play sports, you saw a very aggressive, hard-nosed person trying to win. If a basketball is laying out there and you think you want it, if I'm playing, you better want it because I'm coming and I don't mind getting hit and I don't mind hitting. That's sort of the way I was when I was younger. The reason I love John is he became the apostle of love. Look at his last works. How much love he talked about. Boy, I would really want to change and be no son of thunder, but be that person of love. This sermon is helping us think about relationships, and boy, I just don't have time. But if you would listen, it kind of builds. It kind of builds as it goes. Next point, please. First point is humility. In chapter 1, these guys are arguing. You know, they're thinking about all these big things they're doing with Jesus, the Son of God. What does he do? He takes a little kid, a little child, sets the child in the midst of them and said, unless you turn and be converted and become like this little child, you can't enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever becomes like this little child, the same as the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. You see, we need to be childlike, not childish, childlike in our relationships. You like to be around arrogant people. You like to be around people that know everything, that think they can do everything, that want to lead everything. We don't like that, do we? They don't like it in us either when we do that. And so if we want to be great in relationships, and it's true, probably especially in marriage, we need to be humble people. Next point, please. We need to be people who are responsible. And we're talking in verses 6 and 7 about spiritual responsibility. You really need to start thinking here. You got kids and grandkids? How serious are you about the spiritual responsibility that is yours? I went last night. One of my closest friends in the world is Hoyt Kirk. He's turning 89, or he turned 89 Tuesday. He's already 89. And I didn't get a chance to go over, but last night, Jan and I drove over to Linden and went out to eat with Hoyt. We got in the car at his house to leave. He said, let's have a word of prayer. We got to the restaurant. We started to eat. He said, let's have a word of prayer. We got in the car to leave the restaurant. He said, Roy, lead us in a word of prayer. We got to their house. Jan and I were leaving to go to Henderson. Before we got out of the car, he said, let's have a word of prayer. It's a man of God. He is a good man. And he's responsible toward Jan and me and wanting us to be thought about before God. But this passage says, whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him to have a millstone tied around his neck and thrown into the depths of the sea. You see, he's talking spiritual responsibility. Why do we have 4 out of 10, almost 5 out of 10 babies born out of wedlock? Somebody is not being responsible. I recently was doing some marriage counseling, and his wife said about this guy, I'm pretty sure he's drinking again. I am not drinking. He'd been with me a week before, and he promised me he would not drink before he came back. And I said, well, did you drink this week? He said, no. Well, come to find out, he came to see me by himself without his wife's knowledge. He said, you got to get me some help. I've been drinking so heavily. I've been hiding it. I've been hiding cans and six packs around. He said, I've got to get some help. We checked him into Pathways in Jackson. You see, he would not be responsible for his relationship. He was just lying and trying to get away with and do things. I'm trying to help him be responsible. I'm trying to be responsible about his spiritual life and about his marriage. And it's very hard. It's hard work to be responsible for children, isn't it? You think about people in this congregation who will bring their children into worship. They didn't have time to come to Bible class for their children to learn more about God. And they make it to worship in the morning, but they have things going on in the afternoon, and they don't have their children back for worship. They're not training them in worship and in study and in what God would have them to be moving toward. It's hard to be responsible. We have people leading towards sin in any number of ways in our congregations, but especially in the world. We need to be thoughtful about responsibility, spiritual responsibility in relationships. Next point, please. Self-denial. Boy, I am one of the most selfish people you know. I hate it. I wish I were teasing. I wish I were just using that as some kind of an illustration. But the reality is, it's the truth. It is so hard for me to be unselfish. giving up yourself. Now, this is an R-rated passage. If we were rating it by movie ratings, it would be R. He says, if your hand or your foot offends you, what do? Somebody tell me. Cut it off and do what? What do you do with it? Yeah, throw it away. Cast it away from you. Come on now. Does God really mean that? Does God really, or is that just some kind of metaphorical statement that God is using to help us? If your eye offends you, what do? You just pluck it out and cast it from you. And why do you do that? What does that text say about why you cut your hand or your foot or pluck your eye out and get rid of them? What does the text say is the reason for that? Everybody knows. Better to go into life lame or maimed than it is to go into an eternal hell. And one passage says, where the worm does not die. So we have a good reason for giving up self. And that is so hard to teach. It's so hard to practice self-denial. Hard for me to teach it because I'm so selfish sometimes. But I need to teach better than I am. And I need to live better than I am. Self-denial in relationships. I cannot have everything I want the way I want it, when I want it, how I want it, when Jan has different needs. So in relationships, self-denial. Next point, please. Individual care. Well, it's what I call this. Who knows the parable of the lost sheep that would help me? You'd volunteer to help me. Who knows that parable? Good. I got to come over here to make this better for me. I want to hear. Now, tell us a little bit about what you know about the parable of the lost sheep.
The shepherd lost one sheep. He had 100. He lost one. He left the 99, the 99, so he could go and find the one and restore it to his flock.
Is that pretty good so far? Okay, now, was that sheep that was lost good looking or ugly?
Don't know.
I didn't think he knew much about this parable. Was that sheep smart or dumb?
Don't know that either.
What about popular or unpopular?
Don't know.
What about, you don't know anything else, do you?
I know the shepherd loved the sheep.
And he went and got it. We know that. He went and got the one. Here's what I want to illustrate. That's what Jesus tells here, and I call it individual care. Now, I don't know if this is true in Glasgow or not, but in Henderson, Tennessee, it's true. Some people are easier to like than others. Is that true here? Some people are easier to like than others. Wow. You know, there's some people, you know, last night when I saw my friend Hoyt Kirk, I haven't seen him in a while, he just lit up the room for me. I love that guy. He is such a great guy. He and I have been together so much since 1965 and done so much together. We've worked together. We played together. We traveled together. Wow, we've just had a great relationship. He just lights up a room for me when he comes in. I'm not going to name any, but I could light up. I mean, I could tell you the names of some people who light up the room for me when they leave. Because nothing is ever right. They can't be happy. They can't be satisfied. And so somebody leaves the Green Street Church. I don't know why. You may not know why. What does God tell us to do? Do you say, boy, that person's somebody else's problem now. I've been dealing with them for 20 years. And I'm sick of that. I'm glad they're gone. Is that how we deal with it? You see, it's individual care. Some people are just easier to deal with, easier to like, easier to work with. And if we're going to have great relationships, we're going to try to have great relationships with all kinds of people. Will it always work? Well, no, it won't. But man, God gives us the responsibility of trying our hardest to make it work. Individual care. Next point, please. Discipline. Wow, how disciplined are you? in getting things done, in being who you need to be, in choosing the right kinds of things, in using your time the way that you need to use your time, in studying God's Word like you read the sports section of the paper, or getting the book of Matthew like you get the Sports Illustrated magazine on the first of the month, and boy, you've got to read every article. Would you read every message in the book of Matthew like that? You see, how disciplined are you? But here's something even more important in relationships. Every relationship needs discipline. Every relationship needs discipline. Now, there's a four-step process given here in these verses about how we ought to deal with people with whom we're in conflict. Number one, go to the person alone. How good are you at it? You see, most of us would have to say, not good. There are a few of you that are, but most of us are not. The second step is, if you do go alone and it doesn't work, take one or two with you so that at the mouth of two or three witnesses, something can be established. So you are taking people who are on your side, right? So you can show this guy that he's absolutely wrong. Or it might be a girl. That's not what you do. You take somebody they respect that you also respect, so that when you discuss it, this person knows that they're going to tell them what they think ought to be the right thing to do. And then tell it to the whole church. Boy, our culture would die, wouldn't it? Our culture would die. I went to speak at the Oak Grove congregation near Henderson. It's a predominantly African-American church. And boy, I've enjoyed going out there every time I've gone out there. I went out there and I didn't know the custom. I preached. They had an invitation song. Nobody came to the front and I sat down. And everybody just kept being real quiet and still. Nobody moved. I'm sitting on the front looking that way. And then there was an elder sitting on this side over here. He got up. And he said, ma'am, why did you respond? They have a different way of responding than we do at Henderson, any place I've ever been. People come to the front. These folks just stand up. This lady began to say, I need prayers. I've been unfaithful in my marriage relationship. And she starts telling the sin that she had committed. And there were three people that were standing at the invitation that I didn't know the custom. And each one of them told a specific sin that they had committed, that they were responding for. You see, we would die if we tell it to the whole church. We just don't do that, do we, in that way? So discipline, God tells us that. And then there comes a time after that third step that we may need to count them as a heathen or a publican. So it becomes very important. Discipline. Every relationship. I married one fantastic disciplinarian. I'm sitting on the couch one day watching a football game on Saturday. I'm just relaxed, bent back in that recliner, enjoying myself. She comes in, has the audacity to dump a load of clothes that are still warm that are in the dryer. She said, sweetheart, would you fold those please for me while you're watching the ball game? That's a form of discipline. My mom had 9 kids. When my dad died, there were 9 of us between the age of 3 and 17. She had a handful. I had her by myself for 2 years. Part of the reason I'm so spoiled. But she'd been used to taking care of 9. Now she just had me. I am dressed almost exactly the way I had to be dressed for high school. I would wear slacks and a shirt just like this. I'd come home. This was before permapress. I'd come home. I'd take my pants off, drop them in the floor, take my shirt off, drop them in the floor, put on my stuff, go to the park, play ball. I'd come back. That stuff was almost always washed, starched, ironed, hung in my closet. I could have worn the same stuff about every day. I got married. In our bedroom, we had a chair. I didn't drop stuff. I was good. I didn't drop stuff in the floor. Take my pants off. I'd lay them over the back of that chair. Take my shirt off. I'd lay it over the back of that chair. Next day, I'd do the same thing. And for about 4 days, I'd do the same thing. And then one day, I'm looking for this shirt. And it's not in my closet. My sweet wife, she is so sweet and gentle sometimes. I said, Jan, have you seen this shirt? And I described it. She said, you know, hon, I washed everything that was in the dirty clothes hamper. I got to thinking, Mr. Obvious again, you did this on purpose, didn't you? She said, sweetheart, I washed everything that's in the dirty clothes hamper, and let me tell you, I will. Every time I wash, I clean out the dirty clothes hamper, and I will wash. You see, she's disciplining me. How long would it take me to go, it was across the hallway at that time, to put stuff in the clothes hamper? 20 seconds? You see, and why should I require her to do that? That's what she's saying. That's what she initially said. Now I can tell you, that's what I would say. Why should I do that? But then I'm saying, why don't you do that? Yeah, my mama did. We were at her house, my mom's house one time, and I needed a shower. I'd been playing golf or something. And I said, well, I got to go take a shower. My mom jumped up and said, I'll run your bath water. She didn't have a shower. You were going to have to take a bath. My wife grabbed my mom by the arm and said, sit down. He's a big boy. He can run his own bath water. I said, let her do what she wants to. You see, my wife is a great disciplinarian. Every relationship needs discipline. And unless we do discipline, tell people what we need and share, and Jan had a really good way of doing it, it's not going to be good. We need discipline. Next point, please. We need fellowship. The word means a joint sharing together. When we talk about a church fellowship, what do? We eat. But fellowship is way, way, way beyond eating. We got to share life. That's what this passage is about. And people misuse this passage. They misuse this passage in this way. There's a little verse in there that says, where two or three are gathered together in my name, there I am in the midst of them also. You see, we talk about that when there's only a small number of people, and we were expecting a big bunch, and somebody would say, well, you know, where two or three are gathered together, the Lord's here with us. Is that true? Well, it is, but it's not what that passage is teaching. That passage is in the same paragraph with the discipline. When you are having struggles and you get two or three people together to try to solve the problem, God is right there with you. And you need to think about that, and you need to know that. And then the last point that we're going to stop on is forgiveness. Every relationship needs forgiveness. You know, barring I got in trouble again with a preacher because of my point of view on forgiveness, I may get in trouble with some of you. My good mentor, Brother Guy Woods, used to host the open forum at Fried Hardeman. Some of you have read his work. He would say, and I can see him pounding the pulpit, you cannot forgive anybody that doesn't repent. I'm saying, Brother Woods, your intellect is out the ceiling above mine. But that ain't right. That is not what the Bible teaches. If you look at Matthew 18, 21 through 35, you've got a servant that owed a king what would be equivalent, I read, $10 million. $10 million. He could have never paid that back on a servant's salary in the first century. Did he say, listen, I'm so sorry, I want to repent of that, I need your forgiveness? He didn't say that. He said, if you give me time, I will pay it all. There's no way. He didn't ask for forgiveness, he asked for time. The king gave him time. He goes and finds a fellow servant that owes him about $18 that could have been paid back. And the servant asked his fellow servant, give me time and I will pay it back. But he wouldn't give him time. He had just been given time on a $10 million debt, and he wouldn't give his fellow servant the time to pay back $18. He grabbed him by the throat and had him cast into prison until he could pay it off. When the king found out about that, it didn't go over very well. Well, God is trying to teach us the debts. This is one thing he's trying to teach us. If I hurt you, it's like that $18 debt compared to us hurting God with our sins, which would be so great we could never pay it back. And so in this passage, there's forgiveness. God forgives a debt. In this case, that doesn't mean God will forgive without us turning to Him in the way that He commands. I'm talking about my relationship with you here. You must deal with God in terms of your sins and God forgiving you. But I can forgive you for anything you do to me, whether you ever ask me to or not. I own the ability and the right to forgive if I choose. Gary Chapman, in that book I've talked about a while ago, says we ruin a lot of today's with yesterday's. You deserve what I'm giving you. I'm going to make you pay. You hurt me. I've had spouses sitting in my office for marriage counseling say, you hurt me, and I'm not going to be through until I hurt you in an equal way. The relationship cannot be fixed until forgiveness comes into play. Great, great sermon. Great points that all of us need. Humility, responsibility, self-denial, individual care, discipline, fellowship, and forgiveness. Barton, can I ask you to close us with a prayer, please?